I'm Vernon Trolliger for Optometry Times, and this is 10 questions for Ingrid Lorenzano, OD, neuro-optometrist and founder of the Vision and Sensory Integration Institute in Schaumburg, Illinois. Where did you grow up?
So I came to the U.S. I was born in Colombia, South America, Bogota, the capital. And I came to the U.S. when I was 10. So I pretty much grew up in Chicago, Illinois. Most of my time since coming here, it's been in Illinois.
What did your parents do?
So my mom was a single mom, and she was the oldest of 13 kids. And after my grandmother was left widowed, she had to quit middle school so she could help go to work and raise the kids, raise her younger siblings.
What did your father do?
My dad, he didn't really participate in my life, but by profession, he is a photographer.
You struggled from childhood to college with convergence insufficiency. How did your world change when you learned your convergence insufficiency could be treated?
I felt cheated. It was a relief to know that the struggle that I had been going through wasn't because I wasn't smart enough or because I wasn't trying enough. It was a relief to find out that there was a reason for the struggle. But I also then felt cheated because I didn't understand why did I have to suffer for so long, because I didn't get diagnosed until I was already in optometry school. So I struggled forever to read, and I was given the excuse that I was a bad reader because English was my second language. And personally, I guess most people, it's ironic because when I got diagnosed, the doctor who diagnosed me, he looked at me and he said, "Why aren't you in jail?" And I was so puzzled by why does he mean that? And he then went on to elaborate that people who have problems like me usually don't make it as far academically as I had. And they usually have behavior problems. They are usually dropouts. And it's a high incidence of vision disorders in the jails. And so he went to elaborate about that. And, what drove me to work so hard was that I saw my mother not be an educated person. I saw my grandmother not be an educated person. And the one thing they always instilled in me was, you need to go to school. You need to educate yourself. So in spite of all my vision and struggles and being a slow reader and forgetting what I read and having to reread and reread and study and study and study just so I could get, my B's, it was this hard-driven core desire that I was not going to be like my mom or my grandmother, and I needed to be the first in my family to become an educated person and, not only graduate high school, but go on to college. And then it was my grandmother's desire that she's like, "You are so smart, you can be a doctor." That's what she would say to me all the time. And I just didn't want to let her down.
Did you get over your sense of being feeling cheated as you went through the treatment? Or I'm just kind of curious how that kind of diffused.
So what happened was, I had developed compensation methods to deal with my vision problem. And, when I went to optometry school, those compensation methods were no longer efficient because now, like in college, you're in school for 4 hours a day and, some days on, some days off. But in optometry school, I was in school 8 hours a day, and then I had to go home and read for another 100 pages a night so I could keep up, and I couldn't do it. And so I started to have where my vision was blurry. I fell asleep. I couldn't remember what I read. For every 20 minutes I read, I needed to take a two-hour nap. And so all of these visual symptoms, when I finally got diagnosed, I was given My doctor what gave me prism glasses, and then later on I did the vision therapy, and it helped with the symptoms, but it didn't really go beyond to help me read faster or learn to organize my thoughts on paper. And so while in optometry school, I felt very, oh, this is awesome. This is what I'm going to do. Let me become, make this my passion to become a specialty in vision therapy. And I started to do that, and it helped me get through optometry school. But now once I was a doctor, knowing that I couldn't go to the next level of processing speed and organizing thoughts on paper, I'm like, well, there's got to be something more. And that's what then led me to doing all the research that I've done, and then that's what then led me into developing the program that I now call CogniVision, which really focuses on training the vision pathways in the brain instead of just training the eyes and the eye muscles outside in the eyes.
Why pediatrics?
I connect with kids, I think, and I wonder if a little bit of that may have to be, maybe I felt cheated that I didn't really get to have a childhood and I didn't get to play as much, but I do love kids. I absolutely have always loved kids, and I connect really well with them, and I feel like I connect, I think, for the reason that through my personal struggles, I've walked the path that they may walk today. As a child going through my vision problems, I didn't know to tell anyone what was going on in my eyes. I didn't know that I was supposed to see any different. And so I just knew I was trying my best, and I was always getting in trouble because I couldn't stay in my seat all the time. And I remember my teacher telling my mom, she is just so smart, but if she doesn't behave, we're going to have to find her another school. And I know I tried, and I would always get in trouble with my mom, you know, and I tried and tried. So I think I understand that piece of children, and I see myself as their advocate, as their vision advocate, that when I diagnose these vision problems in them, I'm the one who needs to stand up and make the case for them to their parents and to their teachers and to their school, because they don't know to speak up for themselves. They just think they're in trouble. That's what I lived. And so that's how I connect with them, I think.
We've been interviewing a lot of optometrists doing pediatrics, and one of the stories that keeps coming up is things that happen with when you have the child in the chair. So what's the worst thing that happened when you had a child sitting in your exam chair?
I think probably the most difficult moment for me clinically, and even till this day I feel very emotional about it, was when I've had two patients in my professional career that I've diagnosed with retinoblastomas, which are cancers of the eye. And, one of them was 3 months old, the other one was 5 months old, and I would say that was probably the hardest moment for me clinically, and the reason for that is because everything else that it's like eye muscle related or amblyopia, I'm like, that's cake to me because that's fixable. I can do something about that. But for the retinoblastoma, I can't do anything about it other than, yes, we're going to do chemotherapy on this child, and, you know, and so that's what I found to be probably my two most challenging cases. I think I played more of the parent part in those two cases that I had compared to all my other cases. I always feel like I'm the child's advocate, and I'm standing up for this child. And, you know, I guess my colleagues could judge that based on, well, you saved that child's life, and that is very true. But I just felt like, I guess I always liked it, maybe the control freak in me is like, I need to fix it. And since I couldn't fix it, I felt overwhelmed.
What keeps you in private practice instead of going into academia or industry?
So actually, I was in academia my first 8 years. I taught at the Illinois College of Optometry my first 8 years in the pediatrics clinic. And then the year after that, I taught at Southern College of Optometry for a year. And what I found difficult was, or why I wanted private practice, was I felt like I was more in control. Again, going back to my control freak person, then I had more control over what choices I made professionally, and that I could build stronger relationships with my patients. You do build relationships in academia, but because of, you know, of the students, the continuity of care isn't as consistent. You may get a patient today, but then my colleague may get them next month for a follow-up. And so that's what keeps me in private practice, the fact that I want to build stronger, I've built stronger relationships, stronger ongoing relationships with my patients.
What's something your colleagues don't know about you?
I don't think that I always tout my vision problems. I think it's been more recently, and I've actually been struggling with, do I write a book and tell my story from a perspective of me as a patient? My colleagues are very respectful to me. And, you know, I don't think they realize how hard I've had to work to get to where I am. And, again, going back to what my original doctor said to me, that most people like myself don't become doctors. And so I think that's part of the reason why, and I don't want to make a generalization, but if you're someone who has it easier and you become a doctor, so by easier I mean that academically, you know, if it's easier for you to absorb information visually, that's what I mean to that regard, then you don't experience the difficulty. Therefore, it's a little bit harder for you to relate to others that do. And so what I've found is that, you know, they say necessity is the mother of invention, and my personal necessity is what propelled me to go beyond the current vision therapy and develop things that are more innovative, because I felt that even though it helped me get through optometry school, it didn't help me to the level that I wanted to live the life I wanted it in the manner I wanted it to. And so I think there's maybe a little bit, not all of my colleagues, I know some of my colleagues also, a few are in this arena for probably from their own vision problems, but I think more of them should be aware that these patients do struggle a lot. So I think that's what they don't know about me, that I've struggled a lot. It's been a journey for me, and my profession for me is not just a profession, it truly is a journey. A life purpose.
How can vision therapy be a holistic treatment to improve patient quality of life?
It's because through my journey, I've learned it's not about the eyes, it's about the brain. And for me as a doctor, I've learned that the eyes are just giving me signs of what's going on in the brain. And so whether a patient has an eye muscle imbalance, that tells me this is a brain that is not functioning at high performance. It's having to use a lot more energy than it needs to. And that then ties very much into things like psychologically, that this might be a person who's under higher stress, less productivity. So it's more about the person. And it's truly our, you know, the current science is all about, it truly is all about the brain. And I can look in a patient, and that is both functionally as well as physically. So I can look at you functionally and say, are your eye muscles in balance? Then that gives me some idea that maybe your brain is also functioning in balance and in optimal performance. I can also physically look at your eye and say, you know, I see some bleeding. That tells me you have diabetes, which also tells me physically you're not in balance. And so that's why my approach is it's about the brain, but I read the eyes to let me know what's going on in the brain. And then when I do my treatment plan, I target it that way. I target it as a holistic thing. And whether I play a role in whether it's glasses, whether it's vision therapy, or whether referring someone to a nutrition plan, or, you know, I feel responsible for that because I do see my approach. It's about the brain. It's about your body. It's about your brain and the balance between those two so that you can be the best person you can be and live your life based on choice and not by consequences.
How does neuroplasticity work in vision therapy?
90% of the information that goes into your brain goes through the eyes. So when we treat the eyes, we're treating the brain. And the reason for that is because the brain works by organizing the information that goes into it. And 90% of the information that goes into it is through the eyes. But why is it through the eyes that 90% of it, right? And it's because the tissue in the eye is a direct extension of the brain. So the retina is made up of the same types of cells that the brain is, whereas all of your other senses like hearing, taste, touch, they're external. They're made out of a different component of tissue. They're outside of the brain. And so the eye and the brain are directly connected with each other. That's why the eye has the nickname of the dwarf brain, because it's the external. And so when you target the eye, you target the brain. And that's why when you see anything, whether it be functional or physically, not in balance in the eye, that's a direct sign of what's going on in the brain as well.
Which brings us to CogniVision. What is CogniVision?
So CogniVision is a brain fitness program. It capitalizes on the strength and the power of the vision pathways being the dominant mode of input into the brain. So it capitalizes on that strength to train the brain. And now the science and neuroscience tells us that the best performing brains are those in which different neuron types, whether it be auditory, motor, visual, communicate with each other in a rhythmic, synchronized, timed manner. And because the vision pathways are the dominant sense of input into the brain, it also becomes the dominant mode of training the brain. And so CogniVision is a specific program that uses these vision pathways to take the leadership role in making sure that all the different neuron types communicate with each other in the brain in a synchronized, harmonic way.
How did you come up with this protocol?
I think the fact that I knew I wasn't happy and I knew that I had this desire that something is still missing, that's what propelled me to do more and more research and more and more research. And then as I did the research, I actually had to do research that was outside of my field. And very heavy into the neuroanatomy. And then I had to go back and tie the pieces of the puzzle of the neuroanatomy back to what I was taught in optometry school and learn how to apply it clinically. So I was taught neuroanatomy in optometry school. I was taught neuroanatomy on a anatomical level, here's how to diagnose it, here's where, but no one ever said, okay, well, here's the, you know, the optic radiation, you can also treat that optic radiation to perform better. No one ever said that. And a lot of psychologists and a lot of, they do psychometrics, so psychology is the arena that's doing all of that research. And I think that that's part of what's going on with the problem, why a lot of the kids are getting missed in the gap today. Because we as optometrists are focusing on the eye. The psychologists, even though they're doing their research, they're focusing on the function of vision in the brain. But the two go hand in hand, and we're not talking to each other. And so a child that may have symptoms that mimic dyslexia or attention deficit may in reality have a visual processing disorder, which is a lack of function of the visual cortical cells. But nobody's talking or applying them clinically in this manner. So I did have to go outside into the psychology arena. I had to go into the neuro-ophthalmology arena and neurology arena and start to put all of the pieces of the puzzle together. Currently, MIT and Duke are doing amazing work on neuroplasticity. And they're the ones who are taking the lead on that the neurotiming or the synchronicity of different neuron types in the brain is what makes a high-performing brain. But they are missing the piece that of all these different neuron types, the vision is the leader. So they're doing that great work, but they're not making the connection that, okay, we have auditory neurons, we have motor neurons, we have vision neurons. So they've put together the piece that when these neurons talk to each other in a very synchronized rhythmic way, the brain will perform the best, it'll pay the best attention, it'll process information the best. They haven't made the connection, I'm the one who makes the connection, but guess what? The vision pathways are 90% of the input that goes into the brain. So that means that's also the more dominant way to accomplish that timing in the brain. So that's kind of what I've had to do. And I did it because I love it, because I struggled, because I knew that more needed to be done, and because it made a difference in my life, and now I see it making a difference in my patients' life. So my patients that go through a program in my office, the program is about 4 months to 6 months, because I'm treating the eye muscles and the vision pathways simultaneously. I'm not just treating eye muscles. And so the treatment effect is faster. It has a lasting effect because I'm treating neural pathways, visual neural pathways. And the neuroplasticity research outside of my field supports that when you train a neuron, it has a lasting effect. So that's kind of what, you know, I call CogniVision my fourth baby because I have three daughters.
Oh. Well, that kind of brings me to my next question. What do you do for downtime?
Yeah, you know what? I love so much what I do that I don't feel like I work. Honestly, I really do. Mm-hmm. And I know that you probably, that's what one thing that people say about me. Like, you work all the time. And I'm like, when? I go around feeling like, oh, my God, did I do enough today? You know, because I don't see it as work. I get such a high when I make a new discovery. I love puzzles and putting the pieces together and making things better and why do things work the way they do. But I do love dancing. I love music. I really, really love music, and I do yoga, and I do a lot of art with my younger daughter who's 10. So that's kind of what we do.
What's your guilty pleasure food?
Food. I was just having this conversation with someone yesterday. I love to travel and I love to explore. And one of the things we were talking about yesterday was that why do I love to travel so much? And it's because I love trying all the different types of foods. But along the lines of neuroplasticity, there's research that says that chocolate gives you the oxytocin endorphin, which induces more neuroplasticity. So I do love chocolate.
yet another reason to eat it. Okay.
I know.
That's great.
The neuroplasticity science backs me up.
What's something about optometry you'd like to change?
Something that I would like to change. I feel that with the current backing of the science that supports neuroplasticity, that's number one, combined with the fact that we've changed as a society, where our visual demands need to be even more and more precise and more accurate for us to be living healthy, happy lives. I wish my colleagues would look at it more about, it's about the brain, not about the eyes. And in that sense, and if they saw it that way, they would see that we are in the best time ever to be an optometrist, because society needs us, because the visual demands are greater than ever, and because we are the ones who are best in line to treat these functional conditions, to make people comfortable, happy. So, you know, when you look at it in the approach of, it's about the brain, not about the eye, you could be an optometrist who focuses on nutrition and deal with macular degeneration and Alzheimer's. And even the science in that arena is showing that these patients who have macular degeneration are more likely to develop dementia and Alzheimer's. And again, it goes back to the root that as long as the brain is getting sensory input, it maintains active. And with macular degeneration, you're losing the dominant mode of sensory input into the brain. So the science says, the research says, they're more likely to develop dementia. They have a higher incidence of developing dementia, and that makes sense. And so I wish they would see it. It's their perspective. Change their perspective. It's about the brain, not about the eyes. And we have a huge, immense role to play in that arena. It's not about selling glasses. It's not about selling contacts. It's about the brain. It's about the brain. Changing their perspective and the fact that one of the things that saddens me is that we have been talking about vision therapy for decades and its effects, and now that finally the science is there to back us up, it's other professions like OTs and PTs and even ophthalmology is doing visual neuroplasticity training. You know, so there's some technologies that you can do for patients instead of going back and doing another a second laser refractive surgery touch-up. You can do this type of neuroplasticity technology. Same thing for patients who have trouble adapting to a new intraocular lens implant. You can do this type of visual neuroplasticity technology. And ophthalmology is taking the lead on that. Yet we are the ones who have been doing it for decades. The technology is here, and the science is here. Why are we not leading the? Why are we not taking the leading role that we deserve, that we have been training for all? So that's what I wish that I could change, that more of my colleagues saw it in that light. It's about the brain, not about the eyes, and we are like the best professionally positioned to take that leadership role in making a difference in patients' lives.
Do you have any regrets?
I used to say I did, but now I recognize that I don't, because I realize that whether I've had challenging experiences or happy experiences, they have all shaped me to the person that I am today. And had any of them not been there, then I'd probably be somebody different. And so, no, I don't.
Now, at the last question, we inflict this one on everybody. What's the craziest thing you ever did?
Oh, my goodness. I'm trying to think, because I'm pretty crazy. Probably hanging upside down in a cliff in a vortex in Sedona, Arizona.
A vortex in Sedona? Okay, explain to me how that happened.
So they have Sedona is beautiful, and it's very, I guess, mystical. And I actually met an optometrist at a lecture. We did mutual lecturing in Mexico. And he said, you know, something about me. He said, you know, you should go visit Sedona. You would like it. And I said, okay. And it turns out I did. I loved it. And there's some beautiful trees and some beautiful areas where supposedly the magnetic fields in those areas are higher and different than in other areas. And you can see it by the formation of the trees. The trees grow in a spiral, in spiral formation. So it's actually very, very, very cool. And so I went hiking and through Sedona. And in one of those, I just hanged upside down over the cliff. I did one of those. You know, have you ever done where you hang upside down in the monkey bars?
Yeah.
I did one of those on one of those trees over a cliff in Sedona. And I have a picture to prove it.
What possessed you to do that? I mean, first of all, how far was the drop on the cliff, and why did you do that?
So I have always, I don't know why, but I have always loved hanging upside down and just kind of looking, hanging upside down and watching the sky and watch my relationship of me on Earth as the sky moves. I loved that perception, and I've always loved it, and I've always done it as a kid, where I just love watching the sky move as I'm hanging upside down. And since this was a special place, and that's the thing I like to do, I thought, oh, let me do the two hand in hand.
How far down was it?
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, so it was a ways
it was,
then.
Oh, it was ways, yeah. Okay. We're talking pretty high up. Yeah.
So it was just the complete impulse. What a great place to hang upside down then, huh?
Yeah. I'm like, let me see what the sky looks like from here.
Well, that's too much fun.
It was, and I feel like even as I talk to you about it, I get the energy back again of being in that moment.
Well, Ingrid, it's been great talking with you today. Thanks for taking the time to chat.
I appreciate the opportunities. It's fun. Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.